Yeah, Ryan. I mean, I am extra official here. I have a ring light right here, man. I feel like an OnlyFans model or something.
My wife got me a ring light specifically for this, but I can't figure out how to position it well enough. See, it's better when it's up here.
You look fantastic from this this vantage point. Yeah.
That works right there.
Right. It works very well. Well, welcome to Talk Mental Health with Dr. Logan Noon, we can call it now. You knew me back even before I had a podcast, back before these days, back when it was just Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon, med student Logan Noon. For the listeners out there, me and Ryan both graduated from Pacific Northwest University out in Washington State. I haven't seen you in about, 4 years we were talking about before the podcast. It's a bummer. So I hope we get to stumble across each other sooner than later. But can you, I guess, just tell the listeners like where you're at, what you're doing these days?
Yeah. So like Dr. Noon said, we went to med school together in Yakima, Washington, which is almost in the middle, center-ish. And I'm actually from the Tri-Cities, Washington, which is in the southeast corner. And so right now I chose family medicine. And so I'm taking residency at the Catholic Family Medicine Residency in Richland, Washington. Just started my third and final year, so I'm kind of excited about that. And I've signed a contract to work in the area. So once I'm done, I'll stick around here for a little bit longer.
Right. And I remember we initially kind of formed a bond in medical school because we were both one of the kind of non-traditional medical students at that school. You know, a lot of our colleagues, I felt, were young. Their memory seemed to work better than ours in some regard. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, I originally, going into medical school, thought I would be one of the old heads. I think I started medical school when I was, like, 28 or something like that. But I was, I do have a few more senior colleagues. How old were you when you started medical school?
Well, that 2017, so I would have been 38 when I started.
Right. You don't look a day older than, what, I guess 42, Ryan, you know, so.
Because I'm 44 now, so I appreciate
it. Oh, okay, geez. I mean, math is not a core competency of medical school, so.
Right.
So I guess, you know, you, from what I remember, you worked like in the computer science industry before medical school, right?
Yeah, I was a computer programmer, specializing mostly in web development, but I did do some platform development. Down here in the Tri-Cities, we're kind of famous for Hanford, which is one of the sites that built plutonium that went into nuclear weapons and the bombs that we dropped on Japan. So lots of smart people in this area. And once they started shutting Hanford down, that plutonium enrichment, the government was like, well, we got all the smart people there. Let's build a national laboratory. So north end of Richland, we have the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, funded by the Department of Energy. I think there's like 5,000-ish people that work out there. I was one of them for about 10 years and just doing computer development, computer programming before I went back to med school. So,
Rad. Yeah. So, I mean, I know where this story is going, of course, but, you know, so you're before medical school, you're obviously, I imagine, making very good money or whatever, you know, enough to support a family. I think you already had a few children before starting medical school. So why did you make this transition from computer programmer into the world of medicine?
So, yeah, all growing up, when I was growing up, my dad was a dentist, right? And so growing up, I had three things that I wanted to do. I either wanted to be a dentist like my dad, I wanted to be a pediatrician, or I wanted to do computer programming. And one day I was talking with my dad. I was still like halfway into my first year of college, and I was talking to my dad, and he actually talked me out of dentistry. He loves it. It's his jam. He dives into all the research. It's his thing. But that was one of the points that he brought up, was that he knew me and it wasn't my style. He's like, you're really good with people and you're really good with computers, and you really don't get either of those as a dentist. Mm-hmm. Like, well, he's like, you're smart enough, you're good enough, but it's not you. So, he promised his full love and support, whatever I chose to do, even if it was dentistry, but, you know, just kind of a father's advice. And so I took that advice and I rolled over to computers because it was there and it was fun and I enjoyed it. And I honestly and truly didn't think I was smart enough for med school. Mm. It was like, at that time, that was like the Harvard elite, you know, they were going Oxford. They were the ones that went to med school. And, I enjoyed Halo too much at the time. So, So I got married shortly thereafter, and my wife's, she's a type 1 diabetic. And I didn't know what that was. I know it had to do with sugar, I think. And my dad sat me down. He's like, if you're getting serious with this girl, you need to know what's going on. And so he explained type 1 diabetes to me, and I kind of understood a little bit, but not a whole ton. Ended up getting married, having our first baby. And when you're married and you're going to have a kid, you have all the hopes and the dreams and the everything's supposed to go according to the book, right? Mm-hmm. And my wife didn't. She really struggled with pregnancy. A hyperemesis gravidorum, which is where that morning sickness lasts the entire pregnancy. She weighed less when she gave birth. Wow. My son was 32 weeks gestation when she went into labor. And it was just like all these cascade of things. My wife was in and out of the hospital, lots of medications. So for those that don't know, I don't know who listens to this. IVs are the ones that you'll get kind of in your arm, your hand or your arm here. They last for a short time, and then they have to be replaced. The next step up is what we call a PICC line, and it goes deeper, but it can go higher and it can last for longer. And my wife had to get PICC lines at some point. Just to like stay hydrated because of how much she was throwing up.
Wow.
We were told it was a fluke. We're like, total fluke, is random, should never happen again. So we're like, all right, cool, let's have another kid. So we got pregnant again, and round two was even tougher. More sickness, more in and out of the hospital, more throwing up, more trying to balance like the diabetes aspect. Because if you think about it, she would eat food, and as a diabetic, we'd have to substitute with insulin. But then she'd throw up. But she had all this insulin on board, but no more food.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Or we waited to see, are you going to keep it down? If she kept it down, now her blood sugars are through the roof and we're chasing them.
Right.
It's kind of like this conundrum of like, how are we attacking this? Plus, in and out of the hospital, we're in the southeastern corner of Washington. And there's a few times she got sent up to University of Washington in Seattle, just 4 hours away. Because they have a perinatal unit and more equipped to handle the higher level of care that she needed, more PICC lines, central line, a whole bunch of different things. And Colby was born at 36 weeks. So she was another 4 weeks. And when she was born was when we found out all the problems, right? Because I remember sitting in our OB-GYN's office, wonderful man, I love him. Getting a biophysical profile. And that's when they do an ultrasound of the uterus to see the baby, to see all the movements. The baby needs to move all the limbs. They need to like show that they're breathing. They need to do different things to pass in a certain amount of time. And we were told Colby passed. And so in our brains, because, okay, she passed, she's fine, right? Quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Less than a week later, she's born and we find out she's not fine. Mm-hmm. At that time, she was intubated very quickly. And through the course of events, we found out that her brain was small. Like it was fully developed. Lobes, hemispheres, everything was fully developed, but it was small. So inside her room, we were talking to a pediatric neurologist, and he's like, it's very interesting because in her brain, inside of her head, there's enough room for her brain to be about the size of a softball, but it's the size of a baseball.
Wow. It's
just small. More things and more things. Basically what it came down to, I mean, she had like holes in her heart, two or three.
Right.
But I was like, we'll watch it and fix it later when she's 3 years old, if it still needs to be. I mean, a whole bunch of things. What it came down to was she never developed that reptilian base level gag reflux. And that's what we need. Cause when we sleep and that saliva that we produce hits the back of our throat, our body does not wake us up to swallow. It's just a reptilian reflux. It just happens. And she never developed that. So she would drown.
Wow.
Because she had to be intubated.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 3 weeks of this, a little over 3 weeks, we sit down with a doctor and he basically tells us we have two options. One, we can give Colby a trach and she would breathe that way. That's how we would keep her lungs clear. A nurse would live with us 24 hours a day for the first while. And eventually they'd wean off to where maybe they're only with us 16 to 18 hours a day. She would just exist. At the time, not being a doctor or anything, I was like, you mean like a vegetable? And he's like, well, yeah, but we don't use that term for kids.
Right.
Because they were never not that way. So it's mm-hmm. a different term. And that she would probably die in her mid-teens from an infection.
Mm.
Or we could remove her breathing tube and let her go. And so at 25 days of life, my wife and I, it was like, so think of Seattle, February 18th, right? You're thinking overcast skies, pouring rain, because this is Seattle, right?
Right.
It was one of the most beautiful days. Blue skies, a couple clouds here and there. Sun was out. It was cool because it was wintertime.
Right.
But it was beautiful. And they let us go out onto the porch. And sorry, dude.
Yeah. Take your time.
Let's go out onto the porch and hold her while she passed away. And so unbeknownst to us, the doctor was inside taking pictures through the door of us as we were just there. And so the next day, we came back to the hospital and they had this whole box like for us. And they had taken like her handprint or footprint and put it on this like glass heart Christmas tree ornament type thing. There was like some hair that they had cut off and a lock of hair for her and just a whole bunch of cool things that they did for us. They included these pictures that the doctor took. Wonderful man. Dr. David Lauren, Seattle Children's. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's still there or not, but to this day, I idolize that man.
Right.
So we went through that. Time passes, and our OB-GYN doctor said, okay, we know it's coming. You're going to get sick, but we can get ahead of it this time. So I can get you one more. It's pretty much all I can do. So my wife and I talked about it, and we said, okay, one more. And almost it was, you know, wash, rinse, repeat, right? She got very, very sick mm-hmm. in and out of the hospital, PICC lines, had to use TPN for nutrition. But at 32 weeks, again, just like my son, our firstborn, Capri was born. And so she was our third. The doctor kind of looked at us and was like, you realize that if you have any more, you're going to die. So I'm in there getting, you know, Capri out. You want me to close up shop? And we're like, yeah, let's close up shop. So for my wife's sake, for her overall health, we can't have any more kids.
Right.
Naturally. I mean, we can adopt and stuff like that, which we talked about. But so that's kind of the story. So I'm a computer programmer. I now have three kids. I always say three kids, even though Colby's not with us anymore. My wife just went through hell and misery. And then we come out the other end and I realize that to get my wife through this, right? I mean, massive pain, lots of throwing up. It was bad. We had introduced some heavy medications to her. And I remember talking to the doctor about it. I remember him saying, here's what we have to do. Your kid's going to be addicted when it's born, but we can wean a baby off and we can deal with mom. But this is how we get her through. This is
right.
How she could be in a fetal position on the floor, miserable, or we can get her through and she can have a normal life and be a mom to your son and stuff. And
right.
We went with it, but I didn't realize the full ramifications of what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
So you add to that, at the end of all these three pregnancies, lots of medications in between benzodiazepines and opioid medications and stuff like that, just the emotional weight and toll that losing a baby has on a mom.
Yeah.
And I didn't get it because I'm a dude, right? I'm a guy. I'm a male. I kind of deal with it more in the generic male term of things, right? Mm-hmm. Shove it down, put a lid on it, pretend it doesn't exist. I'm not saying it's healthy. I'm not saying it's right. And you're the right. psychologist that's ready to be like, Ryan, come on, man.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I dealt with it because I needed to fight and scrap to make sure my wife was okay and make sure my son was okay and put this through. And I remember the day we were, my parents were living with us or we were living with my parents. I don't know how that one worked, but we were together in the same house and it was like 3 a.m. And, my wife was on Ambien at the time to help her sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up like 3 a.m. She wasn't in bed. And I walk out to the living room and my dad is sitting in the chair looking at my wife and he looks up at me and he's just like, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I knew what it was because I've been battling this with her for a long time, right? I mean, we tried everything, lock the meds up, hide the meds. I mean, just we've tried everything. And she would always find a way around it, or she'd figure out how to pick the lock, or, I mean, different things to get her meds so that she could numb this pain.
Right.
Right. I mean, it sucked that it numbed out the good, but it definitely numbed out the bad. And that's what she was searching for. I don't want to hurt because I lost my daughter.
Right.
And then our third being a girl, my wife wondered in her head, is this my consolation prize?
Hmm.
And then she feels horrible about feeling that way. Right.
Right.
And so she's out of sorts and she just wants it all to go away. She wants to be okay and be normal, but she doesn't know how. But these drugs make everything okay. So I go out there. My dad, it's 3 a.m. My dad said he found her on the kitchen floor, just vitamins and medicine and pills just all over the floor spilled.
Right.
And you can't have a conversation with her and incoherent.
Wow.
Just incoherent, like talking about hot dogs and octopuses and, you know, carnivals. And I mean, just.
Right.
And that was the first time somebody saw what I was going through. And it's like embarrassing. You know, like, holy crap, I just failed miserably as a father and a husband, and my family's falling apart, and I'm supposed to be able to take care of this, and I'm failing miserably. But at the same time, it allowed somebody to see me, I guess, and what I was going through, and be like, holy crap, you need a lot of help. Let me help you. Mm-hmm. And so the next day, we're on the phone trying to find rehab clinics for my wife. And funny enough, I called her OB-GYN and I was just like, here's the situation we're at. What do I do? And he's like, call this place. They're phenomenal. Get her in there. So we called them and they were like, yep, sounds like she needs our help. We're more than happy to take her and accept her, blah, blah, blah. He's like, however, we need all the money like up front and then insurance will reimburse you. And I didn't have it. I had nothing. And so I had like this great high hope, like, sweet, somebody, we can get her help. And then it was just crashed. And I remember just, I was sitting on the bathroom floor and just, I was a mess. I was like in tears. Cause like, how am I going to help my wife? I would have sold my soul to help my wife, but I didn't know how, right? Like, I didn't have anything. And so I went and I told my dad and he's like, okay. And he just writes me a check. He's like, here you go. Just get her in. And so we got her in, and that was round one. First time she went to rehab. And she did pretty good coming out of it. And then I watched her go through AA and the cool things that helped her there. And that's when I learned about not just AA, but Al-Anon, you know, the flip side, the family side, whole bunch of stuff. And one day, I kind of very roundabout way, I guess, of saying I woke up one day. And I was tired of being the patient.
Mm-hmm.
During this whole process, I met some absolutely wonderful doctors that went out of their way. Her OB-GYN, I had his home phone number. I had his personal cell. I had his personal email. I also met doctors that made us feel like crap. Like, why are you wasting my time? Go away. Same with the nurses, right? Some nurses were phenom, and they will forever hold a special place in my heart, my wife's heart. And some, I have absolutely no idea how they ever got a license.
Right.
Like, they're just unbelievably miserable people, and they wanted everybody around them to be miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up one day, and I realized I'm tired of being the patient. I'm tired of everything happening to my wife. And me just in reactive mode 100% of the time. I'm like, I wanted to know what was going on and why. And was there more that I could be doing? And on top of that, I remember the days that I just felt completely alone. I had no idea what was going on. I know the doctors were trying to tell me something, but I didn't get it because I don't speak their language.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at my wife and I was like, I think I want to go to med school. And she said, sweet, let's do it. So I went and talked to my PCP, the guy who wrote me, ended up writing me a letter of recommendation. And the first words out of his mouth were, you should do it. You'd be really good. You should do this. Not, medical school is flipping hard and you're going to doubt yourself every step of the way. No, he was just like, do it, man. You're going to be great at this. So I started studying, took the MCAT, had mediocre score. I think I was a point or two below average. You know, I took all my sciences at the local community college because it was cheaper than the 4-year college.
Me too.
And I'm just like, when I got my MCAT score back, I was like, well, I tried. But I applied. I got in and the rest is history. I'm here now. So I don't know if that was kind of a long winded. I hope that
was a beautiful answer. I mean, that was a wonderful answer. And, you know, Ryan, I really appreciate you, you know, sharing all those tough times, those tough details. I didn't know all of those details. And, you know, I think it's very helpful for me personally and the listeners, I imagine, too. You know, it puts life in perspective. You know, I got a letter in the mail that I like screwed up my taxes this year and I got to send in some more BS or something. And that was annoying. And then I hear a story like this and it's like, yeah, that who cares? Why am I even stressing about something that's so, it doesn't even matter. It's, you know, it's, I think so often in life we get so caught up in details that really have no true meaning. I had another reminder, and I just want to kind of honor his life. You know, a guy, Colin McGinnis, who I worked with in high school and college, he's probably around your age. He was probably about, you know, 10 years older than me-ish. And we both were ski and snowboard instructors. And, you know, I haven't seen this guy in, 20 years probably. We've been Facebook friends. And he just passed from a rare form of cancer.
Yeah.
And it's dealing with death, dealing with true healthcare pain, I feel like puts the rest of life totally in perspective. And so that's why I almost really truly wish, you know, if you're listening to this and you're not involved in healthcare in some setting, I almost wish that everybody had an easier opportunity to volunteer in a healthcare setting. And I feel like there's all these weird like HIPAA laws and you have to get like registered with all this. And it's like, yeah, but I think it would be such an opportunity to promote healing and promote perspective. And so I really, really appreciate, you know, you sharing all of this turmoil that you've been through. So I guess I'm curious, you know, I have a couple upcoming episodes about, you know, how to deal with like the failure of a board exam and the stress of, you know, both of us went through medical school. So, you know, me and you, I remember being in very similar situations where we always felt like we were going to fail out of medical school.
Someone's got to hold on the left end of that curve, man.
Right. Someone's got to be on the left side, right? On that bottom end of the bell curve. So, I mean, did your tragic experiences help during those times where it's like, yeah, I mean, I failed the test, but who really cares?
Kind of. I think more of it was my family as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, you know what? I just bombed that test. It was, that one sucked. But I got to see my son hit a double, you know? And so it's like, I was at his little league game and I had, you know, anybody that's gone through med school knows Anki, right? And I had my rookie and I'm like doing flashcards, but when he's up or he's playing, I'm watching the game and I'm cheering him on and I'm over by the fence, you know, kind of yelling pointers at him when he's out in the field or something. And okay, I got a 76%. Dude, you should have seen my face the first time he got a hit. Oh man, just like that pure joy. And it's, whatever. I didn't miss anything at the end of the day.
Right. That's a beautiful story. And I look forward to having that experience one day too. I'm not a father yet. But all my friends who are dads who say like, they almost get more ramped up now for Little League as a parent, being able to watch it and experience it from that lens than they were when they were even playing it. And it's just kind of funny to hear that. So I guess I'm very curious, you know, like through these tough times, you know, now that we're, I mean, geez, you're almost done with the residency. I'm about halfway through here. I guess now that we're officially doctors, now that we're finally managing patients basically on our own with some supervision, right? How have these tough times impacted your relationship with patients?
Did you know Dr. Logan Noon has another podcast that he's hosting? That's right. The Zeitgeist Podcast, where I'm the co-host. I'm Dr. Jun Chun. We talk about educational material regarding everything mental health. So if you like this content, make sure you give the Zeitgeist Podcast a listen as well.
Yeah, check it out. It's on all major platforms. Very easy to find. Just called The Zeitgeist.
So after our daughter passed, I don't know, like our whole family came up. They were all there, but it was just my wife and I up on that balcony. And we went down and hung out with them for a little bit. We grabbed dinner. And then my wife and I left the hospital. And she was staying across the way at the Ronald McDonald House. And we were walking back. And it's like, for me, time was encapsulated around us. Right. It's kind of one of those, like in the movies, it's like that slow motion and everything's blurred out in the background and stuff. And that's kind of what was going on, except that I was watching everything else around me happen, realizing that nobody knew what had just happened. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of, they were just living their lives, right? They were going from point A to point B. They were doing their jobs. They were whatever else. And so I kind of think about that when I go into a situation. And I see somebody, and on paper, you're just like, why are you doing this to yourself? You know? Mm-hmm. But the reality is, I have no clue how they got there. I don't. Right. I have no idea what brought them to this point when I'm walking in to see them for a first time. So let's not judge. Let's go in and ask some questions and figure out what's going on and where they're at. And maybe through time, I can figure out more of their story. Because the reality is once you start learning people's story, so many things make sense. I'm not saying they're the right choice, but it's like, I get why you're doing that. We shouldn't right. be doing that. That's bad, but I get it. And so let's help you move past it. It's just kind of, I try my absolute best to never, ever prejudge because I just don't know.
Right.
And then watching what my wife has gone through, when I do learn people's past, I try not to hold that against them because so many times my wife has needed legitimate medical help, but they see that she has opioid use disorder on her problem list and it gets held back. And I'm just like, you guys, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I try not to, I try and give everybody the best benefit of the doubt. I had a doctor once look at me and be like, Dr. Osler, that's because you're optimistic and I'm pessimistic. Mm. And I thought that was actually a great compliment. Because I try and believe that you can overcome this. Whatever it is that you're battling, the demons that you have in your life, let's get through this.
Right. Right. How does, you know, I really appreciate that optimistic attitude. And I feel like, honestly, maybe before medical school, I feel like I almost had more of an optimistic attitude. And I feel like through not even necessarily medical school, but residency specifically, has turned me slightly cynical. You start to understand kind of the shortcomings of the healthcare system in a more intimate level because we work, you know, in this every single day and we're decision makers and how it's like profit driven, it seems like a lot of time rather than in the best interest truly of the patient. How do you not let that get to you? Or do your best at least?
I do. Yeah. It's a do my best. I went into it because I didn't want anybody else to feel as alone as I did. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to help. I wanted to be able to explain. I've always been told that I have a great gift of taking very complex things and explaining it to where anybody can understand. And I wanted to do this for people, right? I want them to understand what is happening to them and why it's important and let them make choices and decisions. And at the end of the day, I knew there was going to be another brand new dad out there who's had all their hopes and dreams and, you know, the crib's made at home and the room's painted and he got the rocking chair as a surprise gift for his wife. And all of a sudden he finds himself in the neonatal intensive care unit because, and he doesn't know. And I wanted to find that guy and help him. And so you're right. The administrative side of healthcare is one of the most soul sucking, soul draining things that exist. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, that doesn't matter if I can make a good connection with somebody. You know, when my day sucks, I want my friend to just listen and to talk to and to, it's the human connection that I think works better than anything else. So even when I know I'm looking at a patient and they're oh, I think I need A, B, C, X, Y, Z because my last doctor 20 years ago did that. And my brain's like, that doesn't mm-hmm. help. We know that now. I can still be their friend. I can still talk to them. I can still explain things to them. I can still have that connection with them that if nothing else, they know I spent my time that I could with them. I don't know if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. You know, it absolutely does. I feel like, you know, it almost speaks to not placebo, but I feel like it's almost the effort of trying to do something can be therapeutic and healing in nature. It's like, look, I'm not necessarily going to give you that medicine. I'm not necessarily going to try to aggressively treat this pathology problem or whatever. I just want to be here with you. I want to experience this with you and do what I can, even though, I mean, I imagine it's hard to imagine something more painful than the thought of burying your own child. You know, one of my exes, their family had to bury one of their kids from sudden infant death syndrome. And I was dating that girl decades later or whatever, you know, 15, 16. And you could still see the pain and the turmoil that family had to experience. It was terrible. It still is terrible. Because I imagine that this is a wound that you'll never truly always heal from, right? It's a scar that will always be there. How have you healed over the years? What resources, what have you engaged in therapy or whatever? Like, what has been helpful? Because if there is a listener out there that unfortunately has had to experience something like this, what would you try to advise for them?
For me, it goes back to connection. Right. We did go to therapy, my wife and I. I've gone to therapy by myself. I have a therapist now that I see. And recently, I'm kind of bullheaded at sometimes and I don't always learn mm-hmm. my lessons. And I was really struggling, just kind of generally speaking, very recently. And I kind of got into, it wasn't an argument, but it was kind of this back and forth that got a little tense with one of my attendings. And again, I love this attending. He's taught me a ton. But that day I was at my bottom. Like I had nothing. Right. I had no reserves, nothing. And so I was very short. And he called it. And he was just like, this isn't helping either of us. And he walks away. And anyways, fast forward, I end up in the program director's office talking to her a couple of days later. And she's like, I need to know everything that's going on, like all the other stuff, because this isn't making sense. And so I just talked to her and she said, go see your doctor. And so a couple months ago, I was sitting in my PC, back to my PCP. And I'm like, here's what's going on. And he's like, yeah, I know. I was just waiting for you to figure it out. And we started some medication to help with just an SSRI and another med to help with sleep and another med to just kind of help with the anxiety. And it has been a game changer. Right. So between my therapist, between proper medication to kind of get my brain chemistry set better. But at the end of the day, it was connections. It was through my church. I went to church and I have some great friends there. The connection that I feel with my God, right? And AA has this tenet of finding a higher being. And whether that's a formalized religion or you just recognize nature, right? Nature is this big thing that I came from and I just want to connect with where I come from. And so I'm going to go out and connect with nature. Whatever it is that you need to do, connect with something bigger than you, you know?
Right.
But at the end of the day, it was all the connections. It was the friendships that I have. You have no idea how much your friendship helped in med school. Like those tough times when I'm alone and I'm up in Yakima and my family's back here and my wife's struggling. And I don't know, should I be here taking this class or should I rush home and take care of my wife and my kids and feel like crap? And then I talk to you guys and it'd be okay. And in that conversation, I'd be able to get out of my head. Where, you know, you're in your head and you're just circling the drain. But then I could talk to somebody about something. We could talk about basketball. We talked about the mustaches that we all grew that
way. Right. That was fun.
It allowed me that moment to get away from myself, to breathe, to have a break. And then I could come back at it fresh. And I don't know. Not to sound like a broken record, but it was always about connections for me. If I just had someone there that could listen.
Right.
The other thing I would say is I want people, hard is hard, right? It doesn't matter what form it comes in. When my daughter passed away, a lot of people, their hearts were great. But it was that she's in a better place. She's doing okay. I mean, all those kind of typical things and like,
right.
Cool. But what about me? Mm-hmm. How am I supposed to wake up tomorrow and breathe? Right. This one guy, one of my friends said it. I got a little card from him and basically it was just, I'm so sorry. My heart is breaking with you.
Mm.
And like everybody else was like focused on my daughter, which is cool. And like, I'm not faulting anybody, but he focused on me in that moment. And I realized in that moment, other people would come up and be like, I could never go through that. I don't know how you did it. I can never do that. And in my brain, I got to be thinking, how do you know?
Right.
And at the end of the day, I kind of like, I really thought about this and delved into it. And I realized hard is hard. And it doesn't matter what form hard comes in. Right.
Right.
Hard is buried down the road. And I get to drive by and there's, I know exactly where it is, the tree that she's buried under. And we drive by and I say, hi, that's my hard.
Right.
And your hard comes in whatever form it is. And I don't know what it is, but you want to know what I do know? It affects you just as deeply as my heart affects me. And so let's not compare hearts. Let's just realize that we're both going through it and let's go through it together.
Right. You know, it kind of, that answer kind of reminded me. I actually just did a quick plug for my other podcast, the Psych Guys podcast. We interviewed a therapist who specialized, actually the therapist who's dating Kelsey J.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. Kelsey J does her surgery residency out here, funny enough. But so her fiance is a therapist, Will Summers, who specializes in acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT therapy, it's called. And, you know, I don't really understand it extremely well, but from what I do understand, it's the acceptance part is accepting that distress, that bad emotions are part of the human experience. We can't get away from them. It's like, you know, so... While, of course, I hope that I never have to bury a child, I'm going to experience distress in some way or another, right? And every single person listening to this podcast can relate to that. We all experience distress. And then the commitment aspect is committing to that entity, that thought, that higher power, whatever it may be, you know. And so I know for you, even without you telling me, it's like commitment to being a husband, to a father, a son, you know, a physician eventually, even though you weren't at that time. But you know, it's just part of the human experience. And you know, thank you for also disclosing that, you know, you were willing to seek therapy and medication, and so it's super. I'm obviously pro disclosure. You know, I'm all about it. I blew it to the whole internet sphere here. But now I'm very curious. Do you have that same level of disclosure with your patients? Do you? When they have a tragic loss in their life, do you bring up the story of the tragedy in your life, or how does that work with your clinical experience thus far?
It's I'm sure you understand this as a clinician. It's a case by case basis.
Right.
I have some patients that I would not tell my first name to if it wasn't on my badge.
Right.
They're nice people, sure. Don't trust them. Right.
Maybe that nice is being generous.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But there's other people that absolutely. So in residency, for people who don't know, so for Family Med in my residency, it's 3 years long and we have 8 residents per year. And the last graduating class just graduated and they're off doing, you know, all by themselves. Training wheels are off and they're allowed to be on their own in the wide world. But what happens to all their patients that they saw here, but they moved away. And so that kind of gets passed down and passed down.
Right.
And one of the previous graduates had a patient that he specifically sent to me. He's like, you'll get this guy and this guy will get you. But I want him to come see you before I leave. This was back in January. I want him to come see you, or February. I want him to come see you to see how he feels, because I think it'll be a good fit, but maybe not. So he shows up in my clinic and on the chart, he's here for one thing, and I do not remember what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I walk in there, and the dude's devastated. about a week and a half, 2 weeks after he saw the previous doctor, and about 3 weeks before he came to see me, his son committed suicide. Mm. And he was just beside himself, distraught.
Man.
And so I just sat with him. And he's talking and talking, and I'm like, yeah, I get it, you know? And I shared my story with him because I wanted him to know, I'm not just saying words. I get it. I know what loss is like. I don't know what... I never heard my daughter's voice, right? She was always intubated. I never heard her voice. I never heard her feet running down the hallway. You know, I do not have to walk by her room where I put her to bed and kissed her forehead every night. I count myself lucky I don't have those memories, right? Mm. He does. He has the memories of fishing with his son and fixing cars with his son. And he's got grandkids from his son. And I can't even begin to imagine that loss. But I wanted him to know I'm in the ballpark, right?
Right. I've been
there. And so with him, I did. And we just sat there probably 20 minutes. And not a whole lot was said. We just kind of sat. And he talked. And the hardest thing was, he liked me. So he switched to my care. And I've seen him a few times since. And the hardest thing for me with him is he'll show up and he'll just be like, I need something more. I need this. I can't, it hurts too much. Can we increase the meds? Mm-hmm. And I've got him on a good dose of an SSRI, and Wellbutrin didn't work well with him. It caused some weird side effects, but we're working with it. And it's like, it's so hard for me to look at him, and this goes back to a previous point, and say, it's not going to take it away.
Right.
You have to go through the grief. You have to feel the hurt and the pain. As weird as it sounds, it will be better for you to hurt now.
Right. Right.
Go through the pain and the grief now. Because trust me, on the other side, it still hurts. My grandpa lost a baby. I think she made it to like 5 days or 6 days. Mm-hmm. And here he is as an 83-year-old man still tearing up when he talks about his little girl.
Right.
And I imagine I'm still going to tear up when I talk about my little girl when I'm older. And I hope that never goes away.
Right.
I want to feel that emotion because that means I did love her.
You know,
there was that connection that got severed. It hurts. And I love it because that reminds me other people hurt too. And this guy was hurting. And so it's like, how do I balance that with him? He knows that my daughter died. He knows that I've suffered and grieved. And he knows I'm on the other side. Right. I made it through the worst of it. And now I'm trying to help him.
Right.
Meds. And it's just like, dude.
Yeah.
You have to grieve. Mm-hmm. So.
So, you know, Ryan, I must say the only thing that you've ever done that truly disappointed me is that you did not become a psychiatrist. You would have been tremendous. If you know, when you finish this family med residency, the door's still open to you if you want to do it. I mean, you'll be, I'm all for it. I'll put in a good word for you, my friend. So I'm very curious, though. What does the future of good old Dr. Ryan Osler entail? You know, you're almost done. I know, me and you are going to take a kick in the nuts, at least for the first however long, to pay off our student loans. Fine. Let's say that's done.
Dude. Okay. This can stay in your podcast or whatever and give hope to other doctors that might be listening. Right. I got so lucky with this. Unbelievably lucky, right? So you have the public service loan forgiveness.
Yes.
Right? 10 years, on-time payments, loans forgiven. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I'm thinking 3 years of residency, which are basically free because we don't make any money.
Right.
I've got three dependents. So I'm a family of four. So the amount mm-hmm. I make is even a little bit higher before. But then President Biden about a year ago came out with that one-time exemption where he mm-hmm. would count any payment on any type of a loan historically, right? You just had to fill out the paper and apply. I was an undergrad and I worked for a number of years as a computer programmer paying back my student loans.
Oh, interesting. And was it at a nonprofit entity, though?
Department of Energy. Okay, ooh. So your three things is it has to be a 501c3 nonprofit. It has to be a government entity, or it has to be an educational institution. I work for the DOE, mm-hmm. Department of Energy. So I applied. I'm like, yeah, we'll see. Who knows? I got 5-year credit.
Oh, wow.
So I got 5 years credited plus the 3 in residency. So there's my 8. I've got 2 years after.
There's light at the end of the tunnel.
There is light, and it's beautiful.
All right. So you're 2 years after finished residency, you have no more student debt. I'm very curious. You know, at that point, you the really anything is capable in your life. What ideally would you like to be doing?
Don't tell my wife, but I have no idea.
Okay.
Like, so I've thought about a fellowship after Family Med, and I was thinking strongly. So when I applied for Family Med, I started looking at some of the combined Family Med psych programs.
Right.
But I'm not kidding when I say I felt too stupid to apply. I'm like,
I mean, they are at like all the crazy schools. I looked as well.
And it's, I just, full disclosure, I failed level 1 by 2 points.
I actually don't know if I knew that.
I failed by 2 points. Passed it my second time, passed level 2 the first time I took it, and I passed level 3 the first time I took it. And so, like, I honestly and truly felt too stupid to apply for some of these more competitive things. I wish I wouldn't have, because I think if I had just gotten an interview, I could sell myself pretty okay. Mm-hmm. But whatever. I love my residency. I'm glad I'm here. I wouldn't change that. But I was thinking sleep medicine as a fellowship.
Oh, okay.
And one of the reasons why, and I was talking to my uncle, who's an orthodontist, actually just yesterday about this, and I forgot who he was talking to. It was either a sleep doctor or another orthodontist, but they're like, I would bet 40 to 50% of childhood ADHD is not ADHD. It's sleep apnea. Like,
interesting.
He's like, if we
related to obesity, I guess.
Obesity or just like poor sleep or like the jaws misformed. The tissue, you know? So it's like a rhabdomyosynostosis where the lower jaw's back closing supply off. A whole bunch of different things, you know, nose issues. So they're not. Because you don't want to be a mouth breather. You don't want your kids sleeping with their mouth open. You want them breathing through their nose. And if there's something going on in the nose, whatever, there's a bunch of reasons that could lead to this. But, I mean, think about it. If you've gone for 2 or 3 days without good quality sleep, how are you functioning?
Right.
You give this to a kid that doesn't understand these concepts, doesn't know how to properly explain it. And now he's acting up and he's trying to be wired and trying to be awake and trying to, like, sounds like ADHD. Let's give him some pills, and the pills fix it. So pat ourselves on the back. The kid. And the reality is he just needs his sleep apnea taken care of.
High quality, good sleep. That's pretty cool. I mean, I agree with you. I think it's like sleep apnea is one of the most like ignored conditions in the world. And you know, a sleep doc would be a pretty cool gig. I always joke, you know, if half of my patients who live with sleep apnea, probably even more than half, don't wear the CPAP mask. If you develop a comfortable CPAP machine, my God, you're the next like Elon Musk, right? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, that is the biggest fight with my sleep apnea patients is, do you wear the CPAP? Oh, sometimes it's just really annoying. Right. And yeah, having good health and not having high blood pressure must really suck. I understand that. So
Right.
It's all good. No, I don't know. I've thought about that. I've thought about just staying in Family Med, you know, helping people. I love that long arc of people, that story of from beginning to end. And so just staying in Family Med and working with people day in and day out. Sounds like a good gig too.
Well, Andy, you still do so much mental health in the world of family medicine. You know, one thing that I hope to maybe do is like be a collaborative care psychiatrist, right? And like maybe work alongside a family med clinic and there's like, you know, 5 family med doc and 1 psychiatrist. I feel like that'd be super fun, super cool. So we'll see.
It's interesting. I don't know what it's like where you're at, but here where I am, there's nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's weird because there's a lot of stuff. We have 3 different hospitals, lots of clinics and stuff, but we're still short on medical personnel. If I refer one of my patients to psychiatry, I am stoked if it's 9 months.
Oh my gosh.
And so between here and there, I'm the psychiatrist and I'm doing it. And I'm hoping that the meds I'm doing are proper and appropriate and that they work and help, because I mean, they're psych meds. I don't.
Right.
You know, once you get out of SNRIs or SSRIs, I start to breathe a little heavier because I'm not familiar with all the ramifications of a TCA. I'm not familiar with all the ramifications of aripiprazole, the second gen antipsychotics. I know they work great. I know people that are on them and they love them and they say that, nope, this is what keeps me stable and going forward. But like, that's not a bread and butter family medicine. But to your point, they've tried that here where out at the clinic, when my first rotation, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 family med, 5, 6 family med, 2 pediatricians, and they had a clinical psychologist.
I've heard of that more often than the psychiatrist, unfortunately. Yeah.
They thought it was a great idea until the psychologist left after like 6 months. And then all the doctors are like, wait a minute, all these patients, you got to build that rapport. You got to build that. And my patients trusted me and I sent them there. And now they're looking at me like,
thanks.
Let you on the next one. All right. You know, I just had this connection and now it's gone. And connection is very important in psychiatry. Right. So it'll be interesting to see. I completely agree. I think that's the phenomenal way to do it. We have in my residency, we have a clinical psychologist and it's wonderful to be able to lean on her. But can we stay long term?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, Ryan, I've taken up about 50 minutes of your time here. You know, I really appreciate the intimacy of this episode. I know it's tough sharing these things. But one thing I've kind of learned through my experience, you know, not equating a death of a child with manic in a psych ward by any means, but like we talked about earlier, distress is distress, and we all can relate to that tough emotion. And I hope what you experienced through, thank you again for giving me your time on this podcast. It's like therapeutic when sharing tough times. It can be, of course, tough to talk about, but being able to put it into words, realizing that your story may help someone else feel more comforted, I feel like promotes so much healing. And yeah, I really appreciate you coming on here and donating your time to this podcast. One day I'll be able to pay you for your time for coming on this show, but it certainly is not today.
Yeah, you'll never have to pay me. It's always an honor, man.
Right. Any last final messages from the one and only Dr. Ryan Osler?
Just be kind. You never know what somebody's going through. Just be kind to them. So
it's a good way to end.
Yeah, man. It was great talking with you.
Hell yeah.